Good afternoon, everybody, and again, thanks for spending your Saturday with us. I wanted to thank the organizing committee for asking me to speak today, and I'd like to thank Sue Robson as well and Lymphoma Canada for all of their ongoing support and their incredible efforts in advocating for patients with lymphoma across the country. So this is my topic, maximizing wellness as a lymphoma survivor. So if anyone's ever heard me talk about survivorship before, and this was a very specific interest that I had in the years that I worked in the breast cancer clinics and with the breast cancer team in Hamilton, but more and more and more, I find that what I learned there, I'm able to stretch across to the patients that I care for now with lymphoma, myeloma, leukemia, and those with who've undergone transplant. I would just like to say Oren has left with his boys, but I like to do the stairs in Hamilton. I like to climb the stairs for my exercise. I always feel pretty proud of myself when I get on the stairs and I'm on my way and I'm going up. And a few weeks ago, I was on the stairs after work, so shortly after, maybe 4:30, and I'm heading up and there's a gentleman ahead of me in a big, heavy coat. And I am feeling good about myself, and I am almost to the top, and he gets to the top and turns and starts to come down. And I was completely humbled to realize that he was one of our transplant patients that had only been discharged 2 days before. So that sets the bar very high. He's a guy who absolutely loves exercise, but that was pretty humbling to me. Don't get too cocky, because you never know who's ahead of you on the stairs. But survivorship as a topic is very unique to each person. When I first started in cancer nursing many, many years ago in the 80s, there was a patient in Halifax by the name of Robert Pope who suffered from Hodgkin's disease, and this is a painting that he did. He was an artist, and he almost used his art as a way to blog his experience. This is one of the paintings that he did that I found especially moving, done in, you know, very muted tones and, you know, mostly black and white. And what he says in his book about this photograph, this is after treatment is over, and he's attending one of his follow-up appointments, and it says, "I've tried to show on my face here the psychological tension that's caused by the question, has the cancer recurred?" And this worry about recurrence can be something that really weighs heavily on patients. And you can see the look on his face as he's being examined for lymph nodes. You know, he's a survivor. He's in a well follow-up visit. But his face tells you that there's still lots of needs that need to be met, psychological issues. Survivors can mask this in many different ways. I think that all survivors have needs. All survivors have worries. If you think about the difference between this particular gentleman and the gentleman that you just saw, Lance Armstrong doesn't look like there's much that would get him down. Lots of things to get him up, but not a lot of things that can really get him down. And one of the things that I would say about him, and one of the things that he wrote in his book, is that I think, you know, he once said, "The reason I ride so fast is because I'm really afraid of what will hit me in the back if I stop." And so although the look is totally different, you know, as a team, we need to be digging down to realize what is stopping this person from being able to reach their maximum feeling of well-being after they've been treated for cancer. What's stopping them? What's helping them? Because if I can find out what's helping them reach that, I might be able to pass that on to another patient. So we try to learn from everyone. The objectives of the talk are to really explore the definitions of cancer survivorship. Some of you might be thinking, well, I've really just started the journey. This really doesn't apply to me. Well, maybe it does. To examine the changing trends with respect to cancer survivorship in Canada. And we want to talk about the consequences of survivorship and some of the strategies to maximize wellness from the perspective of lymphoma patients. I would like to say that I consider myself just to be an opener for Dr. Karukas, because I know lots of you are very interested in the nutrition part of this. And lots of people were actually at our table over lunch asking questions about nutrition. So I think that that was actually the perfect topic to close the day. I'm not really going to talk a lot about that with respect to maximizing wellness, because I know he's going to cover a lot of that. So survivorship as a bubble, and this is something I started thinking about many years ago, is a priority for lots of different people. Specifically for survivors, patients, and their families, it has one meaning. And attached to it are very different priorities for every individual, because it all depends really on how treatment has affected you or how having a serious illness has affected you will have an impact on what your priorities are. But other organizations, like the healthcare community, have to think about survivorship and think about who are we talking about, because if we're going to design programs specifically for patients after treatment, then we need to really know who we're talking about and what their biggest issues are. And national and international organizations such as the Lance Armstrong Foundation, Lymphoma Canada, and other organizations also need to think about it, because they have their own role to play in trying to make sure that we can have people feel, and family members feel, as supported as possible so that they can feel as well as possible after treatment. So who is the cancer survivor? Who is the lymphoma survivor? This is a very broad definition. So the National Comprehensive Cancer Network says that from the time of diagnosis until the end of life, covering physical, psychosocial, and economic issues of cancer, that is a cancer survivor. Even if the end of life comes with no sign of cancer at the end of life, this is still the definition. The Lance Armstrong Foundation says survivorship begins at diagnosis and includes physical, emotional, and practical aspects. It describes the many experiences and emotions that are part of living life as a cancer survivor. So very broad again, and even broader from the National Cancer Institute. It adds that family members, friends, and caregivers are also affected by cancer and also included in the definition. So individuals who've been diagnosed with cancer and the people in their lives who are affected by the diagnosis, including family members, friends, and caregivers. So I suppose that makes every single one of us on the entire planet a survivor in some way or another, because it would be very difficult to run into someone who wasn't the friend of, the relative of, the partner of, or the person with cancer. So incredibly broad. Now, this slide is a bit dated, and I apologize for that, but it is a little bit hard to find images of what I was trying to depict here. So these are, number one, Canadian statistics. I got this from the National Post back in 2010. And it's basically showing you the age-standardized five-year relative survival ratios of patients diagnosed with various cancers between 92 and 94, and 2004 and 2006. So this is really old. 2006 is a long time ago. I'm not showing it to you for anything that I, you know, related to accuracy, but what I'm really trying to show here is, we don't have Hodgkin's disease listed here, but for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, for leukemia, and for multiple myeloma, but of course this is our big interest today, already then we were starting to see a real change in the numbers of people that were surviving at least 5 years with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Now, of course, we were starting to, during these time frames, starting to use more stem cell transplant in the treatment of lymphoma. But since then, we've heard today about all kinds of new medications, bendamustine being reimagined, romidepsin, Revlimid. So the disparity here, the change, is getting greater and greater, which is a wonderful thing. Basically, what it's trying to show us is the proportion of patients who are living now for at least 5 years after diagnosis continues to grow. So in those two time frames, the difference in the bars is about, you know, is between 51 to 63. If we were to see those bars today, it would probably sit out here even further, and in the next 10 years even further. We talked a little bit about the frustration of knowing that there's drugs in the pipeline that I just can't get because it takes too long. But if we continue to do a good job of helping people survive longer, surviving better, while those processes continue to cook in the background, if you need treatment in the future, then hopefully those things are going to be more accessible when the time comes. So it's a very exciting time, absolutely, for researchers, for those of us that provide care to lymphoma patients. When we think back to the 80s and we think about now, we've seen tremendous gains, which is wonderful. It doesn't make being a survivor of lymphoma a whole lot easier, so we're going to talk a little bit about what those challenges are. So maximizing wellness as a survivor of lymphoma, it's very important that you understand the impact of that illness experience on yourself and on the people around you, and the longer-term effects of treatment in order to find ways to achieve the best possible state of well-being. So when I was given this particular topic, I thought, well, that's really, you know, that should be easy. Then I looked at the agenda and I realized all the things that were already going to be talked about. Well, we're already going to talk about exercise, so I can't talk about that. Oh, Deb's going to talk about fatigue. Nobody better. Can't talk about that. And then Tom's going to close with nutrition, so probably can't really talk about that. So maximizing wellness becomes a little bit more challenging when all the big ticket items have already been covered. So I'm challenged, A, not only to talk to you right after lunch, which is the hardest time to talk, but I'm challenged to talk to you about this without talking about the big ticket items. So what is there left to talk about? And my answer would be plenty, plenty. But these are going to be the touchier topics, some of the hard stuff. And so to keep your attention, we'll talk about some, you know, we'll even talk about sex. Why don't we? Because it's probably important to do that. Consequences of surviving cancer became a very hot topic in the mid-90s when researchers started to realize that not so much the incidence of cancer going up, the number of patients being diagnosed with cancer, you know, had been rising, is not rising quite as quickly now as it had been in the past, but still rising. The prevalence of cancer is incredibly high. And prevalence is really thinking more about how many people out there living their lives, working or not working, or volunteering or not being able to volunteer, how many people out there in the world are living with a history of cancer. And because we're getting better at treating cancer, patients are living longer or being cured, the prevalence, the number of people being affected, is certainly growing. I call this the delightful dilemma. Because once you've been treated for cancer, been diagnosed or have been treated, there absolutely are consequences to that survival. And sometimes we tend to minimize those. Or when you come to the cancer clinic, we may only be able to focus on a few priority issues, and some of the things that may be niggling you in the back of your head actually never get raised. So this became very a big interest for researchers back in the early 2000s, and Dr. Haylock from the U.S. came up and spoke to a number of us at Cancer Care Ontario in the mid-2000s when she published a series of papers in the American Journal of Nursing about survivorship after cancer. And in this particular one, she talked about the consequences of surviving cancer. Up to 75% of people who have survived treatment for cancer have some kind of ongoing problem with their health. So that could be something that you don't really even think about every day, barely notice, or it could be something that you live with that you notice every day. So that's a very broad generalization. And this is not just for hematological patients, but for all patients. Fatigue, and Deb talked to us about that. Over 50% of cancer survivors experience chronic pain for one reason or another. It could be chronic pain post-surgical. It could be chronic pain after radiation therapy. Many patients with breast cancer who've had radiation to the breast complain of chronic pain. 70% of patients experience depression, fear of cancer returning, and we saw that look on Robert Pope's face about fear and uncertainty. Young patients, and many young patients with lymphoma, try to sort of re-engage in their old life, and they may have a wish for children and to get back to work, but infertility can cause stresses for those patients, struggles with sex and sexuality, loss of income, financial worries, changes in self-esteem, cognitive changes, chemo brain. I don't want to be Debbie Downer. It's great. Getting through treatment, doing well, many, many years, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, starting to feel good. I'm doing great. But we can't ignore the fact that these things do happen, and that as your care team, we also have a responsibility to ask the questions and try to find out if there's a way that we can help. So Deb talked to us about fatigue, so I only have one slide about fatigue, but it is a really important point. And I love her analogy about the bank. And I talk to my patients about how hard it is to make deposits into the bank account. You know, fatigue is fixed amount. My account is only so full. Making deposits is very hard work. Number one, physical activity, which Oren talked to us about. Exercising takes a lot of commitment when you're not feeling fatigued and you're not feeling unwell. So putting deposits in your energy bank with exercise takes a big commitment. Eating well, and Tom is going to talk about how nutrition can help us add to the bank. Reducing our stress. Oren had one slide there that talked about stress reduction and some of the newer evidence that we have about how teaching ourselves to relax, going through the physical motions of relaxation can be helpful. And energy conservation. Deb talked about sitting down when you make dinner and other ways that you can do that. I think about all of those things as putting deposits into my energy bank. So consider your spending carefully. Cleaning toilets, I'm just not thinking that you put all those deposits into your bank account in order to be able to do one of your should things. That toilet really is pretty swampy. I probably should clean it. No. Get the kids to do that. It's really important to think about what are the things that give me joy. What are the things that make me feel energized? What are the things that make me feel well? And save your energy bank for those things. That's really my takeaway from Deb's talk. Absolutely go and search Doc Mike Evans. Doc Mike Evans or David? I can't remember what she said. That's a great video, too. And it's a terrific video for family members to watch as well, because it's very hard to communicate to other people what your fatigue feels like. I will tell you one quick anecdote. When I worked in breast cancer, I got a phone message from a patient, and it said, oh, so-and-so phoned. She's very fatigued. Could you call her? So the end of the day came and I had my telephone time, so I called her and I said, I got a message that you're feeling extremely fatigued. Can you just tell me a little bit about how that feels? And the patient said, well, I'm so tired that I can't talk to you now. She hung up the phone, like right in my ear. And I was so distressed, I didn't know what to do. So I called her husband at work and I said, you know, she hung up on me. And he goes, oh yeah, she does that all the time. She's just so tired. So a couple of years later here, actually at the convention center, we had a Life After Breast Cancer Patient Education Day. And she came into the room. She looked amazing. She was all dressed up. She had high-heeled boots on. She looked all fantastic. And when I saw her, I said, I'll never forget that day you called me. And she said, I will never forget that day either. Trying to communicate to the people in your life that that's how tired you are can be very, very challenging. And so that video is a terrific one, a link that you could send to your friends and your family, people who tell you, just got to get up, just got to get your boots on, let's get going. They really need to see that video too and understand how challenging that can be. So I'm off my high horse on fatigue, but it's an important one. This is to keep you from falling asleep after lunch. So we'll see how well we do. Sex and sexuality, much has been written. And in the hallway outside, there are representatives there from the Cancer Center Patient and Family Library. And one of the most fantastic things that they've done over the last number of years has created those patient pathways or those pathfinders that you can actually read. They give you a little synopsis of all the resources in the library, a little bit about what you're going to find inside. And there's one there on sex and sexuality. And if this is something that's kind of ringing true to you, I will not ask you to raise your hands during this part of the talk, I promise. However, that Pathfinder is excellent. A couple of the books on that, Women, Cancer, Sex, and Men, Cancer, Sex, written by Ann Katz. She's a PhD-prepared clinical nurse specialist from Winnipeg. And man, I'm telling you, she can talk about sex till the cows come home, and she rings very, very true. Those books are terrific. There's a number of other resources there as well. One thing I will say is that, you know, a lot of couples struggle with intimacy issues, whether or not chronic illness or serious illness has ever found its way into their relationship. So as we get to a certain age, when sex really isn't driven by the lower regions, but is more driven by the noodle, it gets harder. It gets really harder to be able to maintain a good, healthy, intimate relationship. Some couples are very lucky and do that well and effectively for both people throughout the whole relationship. But if there have been struggles in the intimate relationship prior to a diagnosis of cancer, it's very unlikely that cancer and its treatment is going to make that any better. So that's one thing to think about going forward. If you're already having those struggles and those struggles just sort of continue, don't wait a long time to let the team know that's a problem, because there are referrals that we can make and some help that we can offer. There are very obvious changes in the body and changes in body image that can affect the way that our mind can help us engage in sexual thinking and our desire to be intimate with someone else. Scars from surgery, weight changes, losing hair, loss of strength, losing muscle mass. We talked about that. A man who might be very, very proud of his physique, it wouldn't take very long after being diagnosed with lymphoma and being in the hospital for a few weeks to look in the mirror and go, where are my pecs? What happened to my fantastic definition? It's gone. And these changes can really weigh heavily on the patient. Young couples who are still hoping for babies, fertility trouble after treatment with chemotherapy. Men can sperm bank, absolutely, and many young men do sperm bank before starting treatment. However, when we're talking about lymphoma or hematological malignancies where treatment needs to start quickly, sperm banking can happen quite quickly, but follicle and egg preservation cannot. So oftentimes women actually don't have a lot of issues with respect to that. Not to say that all women will be infertile after. It really depends on lots of factors. And after Hodgkin's disease, there's lots and lots of examples of girls having babies after that. Women may undergo early menopause as a result of chemotherapy. So the ovaries basically get shut down by chemotherapy. If you're in your 30s or early 40s and still feeling pretty vital and not having any signs of early menopause, chemotherapy can put you over into early menopause, can cause vaginal dryness, painful sex, lack of libido, along with those changes in body image can certainly make it challenging. So What used to be spontaneous, fun, and easy may now need some work, and it might now need some conversation. And these might not be conversations that really ever were needed between the couple. The other thing, and there's been quite a bit of study about this, is how comfortable is your healthcare team in asking you? I'm not going to ask you to raise your hands, but just ask yourself, when's the last time I went to clinic and they asked me about my sex life? Maybe they do, but maybe they don't. Or maybe when you go, your priority issues, you know, are just so pressing, you just can't get to that piece. But we know through qualitative research, especially with nurses, because that's really what I know most about, that many of them don't ask the questions because they're not quite sure what they want to do with the answer. Your nurses at the cancer center have lots of good preparation, and there is actually a nursing education module that's available across the country for nurses to help patients walk through those things. Not that your nurse can fix all the problems, but there are people that you can see, sexual medicine specialists, for example, and others, who can really help if that's a challenge for you. So please let us know. There's no right or wrong way to deal with those sexual changes after treatment, but the team is there and they do want to help, whether it's making referrals or setting you up with supportive care. There are certainly things that we can do. So the emotional changes after treatment for cancer, some people will say, and I've heard this many, many times, actually, now that I'm on this side of treatment and I'm recovering, I would say cancer has changed my life in good ways as well as in bad ways. I think about things differently. My priorities are more clear. If someone keys the side of my car and leaves a big scratch down the side, it really isn't bothering me all that much, not like it maybe would have before. So I find that I come to each day feeling a little bit more at ease with the little things, because now I know what it means to deal with a big thing. Some patients, though, might find themselves depressed or in emotional distress, unable to relax, feeling so worried and so guilty about, you know, what they've put their family through, grief and loss in lots of different ways, things that you've had to give up in your life. So you might need to look at some of the past strategies that you've used when you've been facing things like that. Many people will say, I've never faced anything this big. I don't have any strategies to cope with anything like this. And that's when conversations become very, very important. And I'm going to talk a little at the end of the talk about who on your care team can help you with some of these issues and how we work to try to understand how much they're affecting your day-to-day life. Change in roles. Many people with lymphoma find themselves in that age range where I find myself with young adult children who really need me more than they needed me when they were 10. And then my older, you know, my parents and my parents-in-law who really, really need me. And my role is really to be the rock, to pull it all together, to make sure everybody has what they need. And when, you know, when I get sick, who's going to do that for them? So the roles kind of change. Also, I would say I'm not somebody who's very used to needing anybody else's help, because I'm the go-to person for everything. I don't know how many of you feel that way. Suddenly to find yourself in a situation where you could really use some help, I'm not going to be able to do the whole Christmas meal. I am going to have to ask some people to pitch in. That can be very, very tough. And people may need to think about that. Changes in relationships. Maximizing wellness depends on working through the emotional changes and the challenges, and your team can really help you. One of the things, and actually we talked about it at my table this morning when we all came together, one of the people said, you know, I look good and I feel good. My family wants me to get back to normal. They're really anxious for me to get over it, get back to normal. And really, the reality is your normal is totally new. The sand has shifted, and you're not really the same. Once you've faced a life-threatening illness and gone through something like treatment for lymphoma, you're different in lots of ways. And so getting back to normal is also going to be about educating those people around you about what is my new normal? What is it that I'm living with? What is it that I think about each day? What is it that gives me some stress? I think that the worry about cancer coming back is something that we don't talk about very much. Our supportive care department at the Cancer Center has a lot of very good resources and some excellent counselors around, not that we can remove the fear of cancer coming back, because we all know that's what makes cancer so scary. That's what makes hematological malignancies so scary. We know that there's a risk that they might come back. We also know from the talks today that we're armed with information, and we know that new cancer drugs are coming all the time, that if a day comes when my cancer comes back, there'll be options for me. But I need some strategies just to be able to get on with life knowing now that I live with risk. We all live with risk. I've never been diagnosed with cancer, but the risks that I live with, I don't think a lot about. What if I'm in a car accident? What if the plane crashes? You know, these are things that are a little bit more obscure to me. I haven't really had to live through them. Patients who've been diagnosed with cancer have lived through the diagnosis, sitting in the room listening to the person say, you have cancer, and all the information that came after that is completely forgotten because I don't remember anything. All I remember is the bottom of my world kind of fell out, and now I'm trying to rebuild myself. I'm just not going to be the same. So families and friends, people who love you, who probably think that they're, you know, really trying to be helpful when they say, you're good, let's get on with things. You look great, you're feeling great, you're cancer-free, let's get back to normal. You know, that can sometimes be frustrating, and sometimes you need to talk to us about how to manage that. What are the tools you need? So, it's not going. You must really like this slide because it doesn't want to move. Oh, there we go. Depression and distress. So it is a bit of a downer, and there's no getting away from it, but it's very important that we talk about it. We've seen it on some of the slides. Deb talked about fatigue and depression. Being fatigued, being in bed, being on the couch can lead to lower mood, can lead to depression. But depression can also lead to fatigue. So it's really hard to know which came first, the chicken or the egg, when we talk about fatigue and depression. Oren also talked about how exercise can help combat depression. The fact that the endorphins that we make when we exercise, as soon as we start to get our heart rate going, can actually be a really good chemical weapon against low mood and depression. A depressed person is sad, and they're just sad beyond what might be considered normal. And it will permeate all parts of that person's life. There's an element of sadness that would be absolutely natural, normal, and expected when you're diagnosed with a life-threatening illness or living with the consequences of that treatment. That's normal. But if sadness permeates everything, if you just can't find the joy, then you have to start thinking about where am I on this spectrum and maybe I need a little bit of help. Depressed mood. These are some of the symptoms or signs that depression might be, you know, latching on. Depressed mood, obviously. Lack of interest or pleasure in activities that you usually enjoy. I usually love to knit or cross-stitch or play hockey or go out with the boys, and those things just hold no interest at all for me anymore. Difficulty sleeping, either falling asleep or difficulty getting up, getting out of bed. Feeling guilty, feeling worthless, decreased energy, inability to concentrate, and appetite changes. It's hard for me to eat. One or two of those lasting for 3 weeks or longer, I think you want to start talking to your team about that. There is a possibility that you might be on that spectrum of depression at a place where we probably need to intervene and help a little bit. It is a spectrum. Over 50% of all cancer survivors will find themselves somewhere on the spectrum at some point across being diagnosed and being treated and then after treatment. And that's in all cancer survivors. So if it is happening to you, you're totally not alone. And if it is happening to you, you have to know that's why the Patient Education Resource Center is there. That's why supportive care is there to help support us in the hematology clinics to make sure that everyone's getting help if and when they need it. And sometimes the when you need it is the surprise. Because I think a lot of people think, well, if I'm going to have those feelings, it's going to be early on when I'm diagnosed, when I'm understanding what I'm up against, or when I'm in the middle of treatment and I'm having all those side effects. A lot of people are very surprised that the emotional changes actually don't hit them until they're like Lance on the bike. You know, he's over everything, and now he's just riding like mad, trying to prevent things from kind of hitting him in the back. That's when you have time sometimes to think about those emotional changes and all the things that have changed. So that might be a little bit of a surprise. Depression is very, very treatable, and so it's important that we know about it so that we can help you. So I just want to take a little break, and I want to tell you a little story about a patient, because sometimes it's a little bit easier. This is another sort of thinking about some of the priorities for survivors. This story is about Jeff. He was diagnosed in 2010 when he was 45 with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. We've heard a lot about B-cell lymphomas today. He embarked on CHOP and rituximab chemotherapy, and he had some radiation therapy in the chest there because that's where he had quite a large area of lymphoma initially. His treatment was finished in September of 2010, and he continues to do well. He's married. He's got two kids, 17 and 19. And he was self-employed as a contractor when he was diagnosed with lymphoma. And like everyone, he had some complications in his course. So peripheral neuropathy, that burning pins and needles in the fingers and the toes from the vincristine usually, makes it hard to pick up little things, sometimes makes it painful to walk. Diffuse muscle pains, hard time sleeping, fatigue and depression, which we've talked about, some weight loss, and reduced heart function. So we do know that one of the medications that we use in CHOP-R can be a little hard on the heart muscle, and anyone who's had CHOP-R would have gone and had an echocardiogram before it began, and then often we follow it over time. Sometimes reduced heart function remains for the rest of the patient's life. Sometimes it reverses itself, but he did have some reduced heart function after treatment. So my question to you is, knowing Jeff now, that's not everything about Jeff, but a little bit, what is his primary concern in the 6 months after finishing treatment? So the answers are number one, lack of sexual desire and arousal. Number two, depression. Three, need to return to work. Four, risk to the heart related to his weakened heart muscle. Five, fear of recurrence. Now, any of those obviously could be his priority, but I'm just going to ask you to raise your hands. Who thinks it's number one? Sex. Okay. Number two, depression. Is that the biggie for him? No. Number three, I got to get back to work. Who thinks it's got to get back to work? Lots of people think that. Risk to his heart related to his weakened heart muscle. I'm only 45. What's going to happen? Am I going to have a heart attack? Fear of recurrence. Who thinks fear of recurrence? Okay, so we've got a tie between number three and number five. So this is actually a chart that I came upon and read, and there were some very, very good notes in this chart about the psychosocial issues related to Jeff. And the number one thing that he talked about was, I've got to get back to work. For lots of different reasons. So that was, there was two tops. I would say they were tied, return to work and fear of recurrence. Exactly what the literature would tell us, actually. So his return to being a self-employed contractor is going to be affected by a few things that you learned about when we talked about him. Number one, he's got ongoing issues with fatigue, which we've learned a lot about today. His poor heart function does give him less stamina. He's a contractor, and he runs his own business, so he's going to tire a little bit more easily. He's got to think about that. Peripheral neuropathy, picking things up, working with tools, might bother his hands. Ongoing problems with insomnia. But he's motivated to get back to work for some very important reasons. Number one, he seeks meaning. He wants to feel normal. We talked about getting back to normal. And he defines himself as a self-employed guy. I've got my own business. This is part of who I am. If I can't do this, half of me has to be redefined, and that's a lot of work. I'd like to be the guy I was before. He wants to contribute in the family and support his kids as they begin to plan for post-secondary school or threaten to drop out one semester before they're done, like happened to me this week. But he didn't. But they do, right? They're so much fun, those youngsters. He misses the social aspect of work. He misses joking around with his friends, the opportunity to think about just normal everyday things and stop thinking about cancer. So he did get back to work 13 months after his diagnosis and with some alterations and changes to the schedule. So that's a really good news story about return to work. I think as a research entity now, caregivers, those of us that work in this area, are beginning to understand the social consequences of patients who've survived cancer and whether or not they can get back to work or whether or not it's not possible for them. Actually, for patients with hematological malignancies, it's a little bit less likely to get back to work at full capacity, and those of you who've been through treatment will understand for sure why that is. But more than 50% of cancer survivors are under the age of 65, and so are certainly at the age when they would think about or consider going back to work if they're able to. Returning to work might fill a financial need, a social need, or both for some people, but for some people, maybe neither of those things. So some people will say, look, I've reimagined my life. I never liked my job anyway. It really didn't fulfill me. I don't have a financial need to go back. I think this is the opportunity to do something different. Or they may say, it's time for me to change what I was doing. I need to go part-time. Or I need to go and think about that other thing that interests me. Getting back to work might take careful planning and a gradual timeline. So this is very important. Those people who are working for an employer and are not self-employed may want to meet with a social worker as part of our team or your care team initially to talk about, well, what do you think? What's it going to be like? What was your job like? What kind of accommodations might be required to get back to work? And then start in those discussions early with the social worker and our team so we can start to figure out how you might be able to integrate back to work into the plan. And of course, a lot of that also depends on the employer. In my experience, lots of people have employers that are surprisingly supportive, but that's not always the case. So you might need a team on your side, so consider us. And then think about the possible physical, emotional, and cognitive pressures that work might bring, and again, how you might need to be accommodated for those things. So some may not return to work by choice. They may choose not to return, or maybe they just plain can't return, and many of you may find yourself in that situation. Yeah, I'd love to be Jeff, but guess what? I just can't because I don't have the stamina. I'm left with too much fatigue. I have too much pain. I can't go back to the job that I had before. Those who are self-employed might find this a really stressful time because the family depends on the money, and if I'm not there, it's not happening. That's why we have the social worker, and that's why we have the supportive care department, so it's important to let us know if that's a problem. When returning to work is not possible, it is really important, though, to find other ways to build social connections in your life, belonging and purpose, reasons to get up and to get out of the house, and those strategies might have to be flexible. So some patients have decided that if they're financially able to do so, volunteering is the thing that gives them purpose and meaning and happiness. Volunteering is great because they have an opportunity to say, here's my capacity to volunteer, here's how much time and how much energy I have, and then they're able to sort of work that into their day. So for some people, that's a possibility. Some will do it through their church. Some will do it through associations like Lymphoma Canada, or even find a way to do something at their original workplace. If that's a place where they feel happy and at home, there may be a way to use those strategies to get back there as well. Just before I close, I always feel when I talk about survivorship issues, it's hard because although I spend a lot of my professional life talking to patients who have lymphoma, talking to patients with hematological problems, I'm not in your skin and I don't really know how that feels. But one of the websites that I find really helpful is from Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in the States. And they did have a survivorship day for lymphoma patients a few years ago. And a lot of the videos and testimonials from those patients are online. So I pulled out some of the quotes because I did use them to frame up some of the things that I talk about and also some of the tone. This one is from Jennifer Rogers. She's a very a well-known financial journalist with Reuters. She was diagnosed at a very young age with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. And she addressed this group. It was in 2011. And she said, "I revel in the beauty and the power of the moment. So coming back to, I've come so far, and every moment that I get is a very special moment. This really touched me. When treatment was done, I just wanted to fast forward 5 years. Can anyone relate? I just want to get the next 5 years under my belt, because then I'm going to feel very confident I can stop worrying about this cloud. Just take a pill and be done. My mom reminded me that if I were to do that, I would miss my son's first day of kindergarten and my daughter's first steps. And it upsets me even now to remember that my response was, I just don't care. I just don't care. This is too hard." Dr. Laura Lieberman is a radiation oncologist from Sloan Kettering who was diagnosed with lymphoma and spoke at this conference. A very interesting kind of take on things because she works in the system and then found herself on the other side receiving care. Very funny, very eloquent lady. She says, after is one of the most challenging times because there's too much time to think, too much time to survey the damage. Who you were may not be who you are, and that's a loss you might have to grieve. And that's a little bit about the whole getting back to normal and what is normal. You may have to deal with late effects of treatment like chemotherapy-induced menopause or cognitive impairment, which we haven't talked a lot about. You just can't multitask like you used to. Your memory might be changed. My friend calls it craft. can't remember a thing. I can't remember what the F stands for, but it's rude. But she called it craft, which I thought was really funny. I just can't remember anything. And these were her tips. Far be it for me to give you tips, because I'm not in your skin, but these were her tips for tolerating this neutral zone where she found herself emotionally after treatment. Except it is okay to feel this way. A lot of people, and I remember when I was quite young, my mom was very sick with cancer, a gynecological cancer. And one day she said, if you're ever a nurse and you look after cancer patients, don't tell them to just be positive, because it exhausted her. She felt every day if she let her lacquer down just a little bit, someone would say, oh, you're not being positive. And the feeling she had was, therefore, if something bad happens to me, it'll be my fault, because I couldn't keep that positive every single minute. It's very, very hard to do. So accept that it's okay to feel the way that you're feeling and find support. So I'm trying to tell you, you know, there are lots of supports at the Cancer Center for you, but I have a cousin who in his 40s told me, I didn't get any support at the Cancer Center. I got it all in my community. I got it, you know, I got it at church. I got it at the school. I sought it out. I sought out a yoga instructor. You know, he said, thanks, but no thanks. I'm just not getting what I need there. So that's always a possibility. You have to find what works for you. Integrative medicine, friends and family, etc. Focus on the moment. Put joy in every day was one of her messages. Find humor. She's very funny. If you can find that link, and maybe what I'll try to do is get that link for the website for Sue. And share your experience to help others was her other piece of advice. So as you continue to come to the Cancer Center after the end of treatment, obviously there's lots of reasons that we have you come, and hopefully lots of reasons that you want to continue to come and see us. Number one, most importantly, disease surveillance, and make sure that the disease is staying away, staying in a manageable state. So some people are living with no evidence of lymphoma. Some patients are living with some evidence of lymphoma that's really not changing. When things change, that's when we need to start having discussions about what to do next. Research is incredibly important, because this whole idea about surviving 5 years after lymphoma, or 10 years, or 15, or 20, this is really relatively new in the last 15 years or so. So we're only just starting to learn what the long-term effects of lymphoma treatment are. And so you might be approached to participate in a study to understand that better. Monitoring and managing late side effects from chemotherapy, radiation, and surgery. Health promotion activities, reducing your risk. So we talked about exercise, we'll talk about nutrition. What about getting vaccinated? What about the flu shot? What about smoking? All of those things. Health teaching, assessing and intervening in the psychosocial consequences, which I've talked a lot about. Some people might need special services like rehab, like CanWell, like physiotherapy, some of the things Oren was talking about, or even genetic counseling. And when I say that, I'm thinking more around patients in general. Some of the colorectal and breast cancer patients do carry hereditary genes that require genetic counseling. And all patients are different. They may fall into different risk categories and need different kinds of follow-up. So when you're in the waiting room, you may not have the same follow-up schedule as somebody else. It all depends on you, how long ago your treatment was, and what kind of lymphoma you had in the first place. How many people have been asked to do the questionnaire when they come to clinic? Hands up high. How many people love doing it? Keep your hands up. Love doing it. Keep them high. Nobody. And you look at those questions, you're like, seriously, I just answered this question like 4 weeks ago. I got to answer it again. Okay, whatever. Tick, 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 tick. ESAS is a really interesting tool. It has been proven to be helpful if we're answering it honestly. And actually, a lot of patients will say to me, well, what do they do with that information? Anyway, fill it out. No one ever talks to me about it. But you heard from Deb. She's actually always looking at the data from the ESAS questionnaires around what are the most distressing symptoms. And sometimes in follow-up, there really aren't any, and that's great. But it's important for you to know you recognize these: pain, tiredness, nausea, depression, anxiety, drowsiness, appetite, well-being, and shortness of breath. And basically, I give a score somewhere between 1 and 10. On our side of the picture, anybody who scores 4 or higher on any of those symptoms is probably somebody who needs a little bit more assessment and some intervention. So this would be something that the nurses and the physicians would be looking at in the clinic pod and going, I think I'm going to talk to them about supportive care. Maybe I will refer them to a nutritionist. Maybe they need some counseling and health teaching around. So it's very important, I think, to, as much as I think it's tough and I think people do get tired of doing it, I do think it's worth doing. And it's worth doing not only if you're having symptoms, but it's also great for us to know when you're actually not having any problems whatsoever. That's a super thing. So this is your team. obviously your hematologist, your primary nurse in the clinic, physiotherapist, we have chaplains, we have social workers and psychologists if you're on the ward, nurse practitioners and residents and all kinds of people to help you. Psychiatrists and psychologists, I think, are very, very important. Our social workers are super busy. I'm hoping that most of you have touched base with them. And I think everyone else, and occupational therapy is the other one I haven't talked about, and very helpful in trying to get back integrated into life like before, occupational therapists. I love this mandala. I found this online. The mandala was drawn as a healing symbol. It includes all the rich colors in my life, and that black shape is the cancer. It moved around my center, but it did not extinguish the brightness of